8. The Chronology. 2 days later, Poirot and I were in the village of Chiddingfold, taking afternoon tea in the home of Inspector Marcus Capling of Surrey Police. Our inquiries had come up with the name of Capling as having been in charge of the investigation into Frank Devonport's murder. Happily, he had at once expressed a willingness to talk to us, and upon our arrival had turned out to be a congenial fellow. He looked far too young to be a police inspector. His wife had greeted us at the door with what had struck me as excessive delight, and I soon understood why. She was one of those women who puts plates loaded with all sorts of baked treats in front of you, and then cajoles until all present have eaten enough to rupture their stomachs. Poirot and I were not so much welcome guests as necessary repositories for her unbridled catering. Mercifully, a neighbour had burst into the Capling sitting room just as I was being coaxed through a third fruit scone with news that the Dunbar baby, a little cherub if ever there was one, was now ready to receive visitors, and Mrs. Capling had hurried away with a quantity of wrapped cake slices that would alarm any sensible newborn. Once the two women had left, Poirot said to Capling, "Tell us about the murder of Frank Devonport. Do not omit a single detail, please." We had already described to him all that had taken place on our journey from London and during our brief stay at Kingfisher Hill. Capling had said, "Well, blow me down," so often that I'd lost count. "You know that Helen Acton confessed to the murder immediately," he said in response to Poirot's question. "I know that she confessed," said Poirot. "I did not know that it was immediate." "Oh, yes, as one of my men said at the time, she was busy confessing while poor old Frank's body was still warm. Stuck to her story ever since, too. And soon she'll pay the price for what she did." Capling frowned and rubbed his chin. "If indeed it was she who committed the crime. Now that Daisy Devonport has confessed, I'm starting to wonder if I might not have been right all along." "Daisy, though?" He shook his head. "I find it difficult to believe she killed her brother. But then again, she's a hard one to make sense of. Probably the most interesting character of all the Devonports. And I've been wrong before, Monsieur Poirot. Many, many times in my daily life and in my work." He said this quite cheerfully, apparently undisturbed by manifold errors, both personal and professional. "My sincere condolences, mon ami. That cannot be a pleasant experience, I'm sure." "Ah, well," Capling shrugged. "You say you've informed the Home Office of the latest developments. Daisy Devonport's confession, I mean." "Yes, I have spoken to my friends there," said Poirot. "It was the first visit I made on my return to London." "Ah, I only asked because, well, I've heard nothing." "Everything is in hand," Poirot told him. "The execution of Helen Acton is to be delayed, and a new investigation of the murder of Frank Devonport will commence. I am afraid that, for a reason I am sure you will understand..." Poirot paused tactfully. "Oh, quite. Capling looked relieved. "I expect the Home Office will send it up to Scotland Yard. The Devonport family, well, they're not any old Jack or Jill. The case was only assigned to us local police because it seemed so straightforward. Until one met the people involved, that is. It was thought that to keep it as a Surrey police matter might put a limit on any damage to the family's name. Keep it out of the London newspapers, you know." "Indeed," said Poirot. "However, now that this solved case is once again unsolved, Scotland Yard will take it on from here." He gestured extravagantly in my direction, like a magician celebrating the reappearance of a formerly vanished object. "Inspector Catchpool will lead the investigation, and I will offer to him what assistance I can. N'est-ce pas, Catchpool?" "Something like that," I agreed. He and I both knew that it would be the other way round. In truth, I wish that Poirot could lead the charge officially and be seen to do so by all involved. I was not looking forward to our return to Little Quay, when I would have to brandish my Scotland Yard credentials and explain to the Devonports that, having thrown me out of their home only days ago, they now had no choice but to admit me once again and answer many upsetting and intrusive questions. That I would be accompanied by Poirot, my partner in deceiving them, would not help to secure a warm reception. I had put all of these points to Poirot on the way to Chiddingfold, and he had waved them aside, accusing me of unwarranted pessimism. All will be well, mon cher. Place your trust in Poirot, who has never let you down. Now, he said to Marcus Capling, Inspector, you said a moment ago that you might have been right all along. Right about what? Did you not believe that Helen Acton was guilty, even when she said so? No, I did not, not at first. She insisted upon it, though, and so I thought, well, why would she risk her neck if she was innocent? Nevertheless, your first opinion was that she was innocent. Yes, yes, I'm afraid it was. What made you think so? Her grief after the tragedy, for one thing. If you'd seen her, Monsieur Poirot, you'd have thought the same, I'm sure. Never have I seen a plainer case of a woman who wished with all her breaking heart that the man she loved was alive and not dead. The man she loved? Poirot sat forward in his chair. He spoke quickly. Don't you mean to say the brother of the man she loved? She is engaged to be married to Richard Devonport. Is she not? Richard Devonport is alive. Capling's eyes widened. No, no, Monsieur Poirot. Now Helen Acton is betrothed to Richard Devonport. That is quite true. But that came later, after Frank's death. Poirot and I looked at one another, unable to believe what we were hearing. His eyes appeared more vividly green and jewel-like than usual, I noticed, like two emeralds under a bright light, though the Capling small sitting room was dimly lit. Many people don't believe me when I describe what happens to Poirot's eyes at significant moments in the puzzle-solving process he so loves, but it is quite true. I've seen it happen many times. His eyes take on a peculiar green glow, as if lit from within. I cleared my throat and said to Capling, Do you mean to tell us that Helen Acton and Frank Devonport were... Well, what, precisely? Why, when Frank died, they were engaged to be married, said Capling. By all accounts, they were inseparable and wildly in love. All the family said so. Then how does Richard Devonport fit into the picture? I asked. Capling shook his head. That's the strangest part of it all. You see, before Frank died, Helen Acton did not know Richard Devonport at all, and he did not know her. Yet they ended up betrothed to one another? Poirot sounded as baffled as I felt. And this happened after she confessed to killing his brother? Oh, it's even queerer than that, Monsieur Poirot. There are so many aspects of the situation that defy explanation, I hardly know where to begin. You see, before he introduced Helen to his family as his fiancée, Frank had been estranged from the other Devonports for some time, just as Daisy told you. You know the story. He stole from the family coffers in order to help a friend in need. I dare say Daisy told you who the friend was. The man she plans to marry, Oliver Proud. In my head, I drew more lines of connection between the Devonports and the various members of their circle. I had already added a new one to my mental picture that led from Helen to Frank, making him not only her murdered almost brother-in-law, but also her murdered almost husband. Now I created a new line on my imaginary diagram, one that linked Oliver Proud directly to Frank Devonport. Proud was no longer simply Daisy Devonport's fiancé. Suddenly, he was also the good friend of Frank Devonport and the recipient of the stolen money, which meant that... My mind blurred, then went blank. Too many scones had impaired my deductive functions, but I got there in the end. What this meant was that Daisy Devonport, according to her, had both murdered her brother, Frank the thief, and agreed to marry his accomplice and the beneficiary of his crime. Why would Daisy kill one of the people involved in the theft and consent to marry the other? Unless her motive for killing Frank had nothing to do with the stolen money. Equally likely, I reminded myself, was that she had not murdered Frank at all and was lying about having done so. Ah, so you didn't know that Oliver Proud was the friend Frank Devonport stole for, said Capling. No. Richard Devonport, I now see, has told us very little. He did not tell us that Helen Acton was engaged to be married to his brother at the time of Frank's murder. Poirot shook his head. Having invited Hercule Poirot to his home and asked urgently for his help, but Monsieur Richard does not believe my help to be necessary anymore. He is certain that no one will hang for the murder of his brother, now that there are two confessions, each one contradicting the other. Alors, he feels no obligation to furnish me with the additional information. He claims to know no reason why anyone at all should have wished to kill Frank. Yet kill him somebody did. The response from the Home Office so far suggests that Richard Devonport might be correct in his assessment, I told Capling. Helen Acton's execution has been delayed, and if she and Daisy Devonport both continue to swear their different versions of what happened, it could well be cancelled altogether. I turned to Poirot. I say, imagine if they both wanted Frank dead and worked up this whole plot in advance, knowing that if they both confessed, it would be impossible for the blame to land decisively on either of them. Oh, Catchpool. Anyone would think that you joined the police only today and have not yet received the basic training. Have you forgotten that Daisy Devonport went to considerable effort to conceal her name and identity from me when we first met, and also her destination? She never wished for her confession to reach the police or the Home Office in time to save the life of Helen Acton. Privately, I thought, but what if Daisy is cleverer than we think? What kind of man asks for his brother's murderer's hand in marriage? I asked Marcus Capling. A man who believes she's innocent, I suppose, came the reply. I turned to Poirot. Sidney Devonport certainly thinks Helen Acton is guilty. Richard is plainly terrified of his father. He cringes with fear whenever Sidney opens his mouth, jumps to his every whim. What is your point, mon ami? Are we to suppose that Sidney has no objection to Richard's engagement to Helen Acton, or that Richard has been willing to defy him on that matter alone while deferring to him in everything else? We do not at present know enough about the Devonport family members and their relationships with one another, said Poirot. It is too early to make suppositions. Do you know about Oliver Prout's father? Capling asked. Otto, his name was. Mademoiselle Daisy mentioned him, but not by name. He had a role in the story that she told me. It was not only for Oliver Prout that Frank Devonport stole all that money, said Capling. It was also for the sake of Oliver's father, Otto, who was old and sick. The two of them, father and son, had lost all their money when the stock exchange had its little setback. Frank wanted to help them both. When Otto Proud died, he was once more a wealthy man. That was thanks to Frank Devonport. He and Oliver invested the stolen money and struck gold. Otto was able to live out his last days in comfort. He died knowing that Oliver would have no money worries for the rest of his life. Not unless he made some very unwise decisions. Capling wagged his finger suddenly and said ruefully, which is always possible where money's involved. It sounded as if he might have been speaking from experience. Was Daisy Devonport engaged to Oliver Proud when her brother Frank died? Poirot asked. Capling nodded. She was, although it had not been long, I don't think, maybe only a matter of weeks. I see. So the plan for them to marry was not something that happened after the fact, as it were. Not at all. But why do you ask? Said Capling. It is useful, always, to understand the chronology of human relationships, Poirot told him. How everything fits together. There are many questions I would have liked to ask Richard Devonport. Many that I did ask him between Kingfisher Hill and London. But he declined to answer, did he not, Catchpool? Yes, he snapped shut like a clamshell, I said. Once he'd satisfied himself that neither Helen Acton nor Daisy could now hang for Frank's murder. I don't see that as being true at all, Capling interjected. I agree with you, I said. Nothing is guaranteed. This is a highly irregular situation. However, it is what Richard Devonport believes. And it's why he told Poirot and me that he could not answer questions about his family and concentrate on driving the car at the same time. An excuse, said Poirot. He tried various others too, I said. At one point, he professed to be too exhausted by the events of the day and suggested that further discussion would be impossible for him. Personally, I think he has a theory about who did kill his brother, but for some reason doesn't want to tell us. He doesn't believe it was either Helen or Daisy, that's for sure.
Yes, it is interesting, said Poirot. Who else in the household would he wish to protect?
His mother, perhaps? I thought of an idea I preferred. Or his father. When one fears a parent to the extent that Richard Devonport fears Sidney Devonport, one might be unwilling to risk an accusation of murder in case the accused is found not guilty and returns home to punish the accuser.
A very interesting notion, Catchpool.
Poirot gave me an encouraging smile, and I felt inordinately pleased.
Inspector Capling, I have made arrangements to talk to Helen Acton first thing tomorrow, but in the meantime, my curiosity gets the better of me. Did she include in her confession a motive?
I assume you asked her why she would kill this man she loved and to whom she was betrothed.
Oh, she was very clear about the why of it, said Capling. She said, and insists to this day, that she did it because she loved his brother Richard more. Now, if you'll pardon my saying so, I've always found that hard to believe. Partly because, as I've told you, Helen and Richard did not know each other before Frank died, and, well, not that I'm an expert on women's tastes, but anyone would have had to concede that Frank Devonport was a fine specimen, tall, handsome as a movie star. That's what my wife said when I showed her a photograph. I can't see any woman falling for his short, plain, and quite unremarkable brother instead. It's not only down to physical appearances, mind you. Frank, by all accounts, was a man of real character, a born leader. Charismatic, is what everyone said, everybody I spoke to. And you've met Richard. He's a timid little mouse, isn't he? Scurrying around in the background, hoping not to be noticed. No, I can't see that the future wife of Frank Devonport would lose her heart to his brother. Although I could be wrong. I suppose people want all sorts of things for all kinds of reasons, don't they?
Nobody would believe that murdering a chap's brother was the way to win his heart, I said.
Poirot shook his head. Remember, Catchpool, we know nothing of the strength or weakness of the Devonport brothers' fraternal bond. Did Richard seem to you eager for Frank's killer to be identified and brought to justice? To me, he did not.
He turned to Marcus Capling.
Twice you have told us that Helen Acton and Richard Devonport did not know one another. Please explain and be precise. Do you mean that their acquaintance was merely superficial or...
Oh, I can be precise, Capling chuckled. I can get it down to hours, probably minutes and seconds, if you'd like.
Minutes and seconds?
Poirot smoothed down his moustaches. I braced myself for whatever we were about to be told. I expected it to make as little sense as everything else that had befallen us since we had waited on Buckingham Palace Road to board that infernal orange and blue motor coach.
Oh, yes, Monsieur Poirot. It was mere hours before Frank died, you see, when they met. Mon ami, do you mean to suggest...
Yes, Capling said.
Richard Devonport and Helen Acton made one another's acquaintance for the very first time on the day of Frank Devonport's murder.
Poirot rose from his chair and walked over to the window, where he stood and looked out at the row of small cottages opposite the Capling's house. It was some time before he spoke again. A low-pitched muttering emanated from him, punctuated now and then by muffled exclamations. As I watched the back of his singular, egg-shaped head, I half fancied that it grew larger before my eyes, as the finest brain in the land swelled with new thoughts, deductions, and questions. Eventually, he asked Capling,
"Did you tell Helen Acton that you did not believe her story, when she told you that she had known Richard Devonport for only one day?"
"Less than that," said Capling. "It was a matter of hours, a small portion of a day."
"Yet she claimed to have been driven to kill for his sake?"
"Not exactly for his sake, Monsieur Poirot. She said only that she loved him and
did what she did to Frank in order to be free to marry Richard.
I made a scornful noise. Why not simply break off her engagement to Frank Devonport if Richard was the one she loved? There was no need to kill him for that reason alone. Helen Acton is alive, and that's all there is to it. She might have murdered Frank, but if she did, it was for a different reason.
All I can tell you is what she told me, Inspector, Capling said. What she kept telling me every time we spoke. I did it because I did not love Frank anymore. I loved Richard. He was the one I wanted. Those same words over and over.
Once I'd learned the truth from the others about the timing of her association with Richard Devonport, I spoke to her again and, well, I put it to her that she and Richard had met only on that very day, the day Frank died.
What did she say to that? Poirot asked.
She did not deny it, but she also would not confirm it. And I got the same response from Richard Devonport when I asked him about it.
About when they first met?
Capling nodded. Neither of them would answer me on the matter of whether or not they first clapped eyes on each other on that day. All I can tell you is everybody else present swears that they did.
We will come to the details of the day in a moment, said Poirot. Inspector, did Helen Acton claim, as she ever claimed, that for Monsieur Richard she experienced love at first sight?
Marcus Capling smiled.
Did my heart love till now, forswear its sight, for I ne'er saw true beauty till this night.
Romeo and Juliet, I said reflexively. I'd studied it at school, and its lessons had stayed with me. Pursue your romantic urges with no thought for what society will allow, and there's a good chance that you will end up in a disadvantageous situation.
No, Helen has never said anything about love at first sight to me,
Capling answered Poirot's question.
Nor to anybody else, as far as I'm aware. If I had to guess, well, I would say that she and Richard must have known each other already before Frank died, but for some reason did not wish to admit it.
How soon after the death of Frank did Mademoiselle Helen become engaged to his brother?
Poirot asked.
2 weeks.
Richard visited her twice in jail. He was keen to do so once he heard that she had named her love for him as the why of it all. In fact, Capling broke off.
What? Said Poirot.
I've remembered something. I was there when Richard was first informed of Helen's stated reason for the crime she had committed. Never have I seen a man look more astonished or appalled.
Appalled? I said.
Well, yes, said Capling. Imagine how you would feel upon discovering that the reason your brother was dead was you.
I'd have felt terribly guilty if I'd been in Richard's position.
Would you have wanted or agreed to marry your brother's murderer 2 weeks later? I asked him.
My friend Catchpool is notorious for never agreeing to marry anybody, Poirot told Capling. He has driven his mother to the end of her wits.
Oh, you should get yourself married, Inspector. Capling glanced down at the remaining scones on the table in front of him and smiled.
You too, Monsieur Poirot. As a married man, I'd be the first to recommend it.
So Richard Devonport was appalled to be loved by the woman who killed his brother, said Poirot thoughtfully. Yet soon afterwards, he puts a ring on the finger of this same woman.
A ring on her finger, Capling echoed. It's funny that you should say that, Monsieur Poirot.
What is funny?
Poirot asked.
At the time of Helen Acton's arrest, she was wearing the ring Frank had given her. A solitaire ruby it was, very striking.
A ruby? I looked at Poirot. Inspector, you've just described Daisy Devonport's engagement ring. Don't you remember, Poirot? She was wearing it when we travelled together on the coach.
Poirot nodded. That's what I'm trying to tell you, said Capling. When I first met Daisy Devonport, she was engaged to be married to Oliver Proud and wore the ring he had bought for her, an emerald with diamonds around it. Helen Acton, meanwhile, was wearing Frank's ring, the ruby solitaire. But after the first time Richard visited her at Holloway Prison, Helen asked the guards to find her ruby ring among her effects and send it on to Richard at Kingfisher Hill. A matter of days later, when I visited the Devonport family, Daisy's emerald and diamond ring was no longer on her finger. Instead,
there was the ruby solitaire that Frank had given Helen.
"Yet Mademoiselle Daisy remains betrothed to Oliver Proud," said Poirot.
"This is most extraordinary. C'est merveilleux."
He clapped his hands together. "Why is it marvellous?" I demanded. "I don't think it's marvellous at all. Frankly, Poirot, I don't know why you're bothering."
"Don't you?" His eyes glinted that bright green again. "It gives me great pleasure to bother Catchpole.
But you'll never make any sense of it. It's impossible. A riddle without an answer. Helen Acton is lying, and Daisy Devonport is lying. Richard Devonport has told us so little that he might as well have lied. In fact, he probably has. And now this business with the rings and people deciding to marry when they barely know each other, never mind the one that's been condemned to death, which generally makes marriage impossible. And as for Joan Blythe..." I made a disgusted noise.
"Aha! I wondered when you would mention her," said Poirot.
He smiled at Capling, as if I was a joke to be shared between the two of them.
"You always come back to her, n'est-ce pas? You believe she is connected to our other mysteries?"
"All I know is that she started it. She was the beginning of everything, ceasing to make the slightest bit of sense. And all that has happened since, all that we have seen and heard of, Poirot, without exception, has made even less sense."
"And this lack of sense infuriates you," said Poirot softly.
"Je comprends bien, but you are in error, my friend, in so many ways. Later, I shall explain to you why, and you will feel much better."
He turned to Capling.
"Inspector, let us speak of the indisputable facts of Frank Devonport's death. Start at the beginning, please, and tell me what is known."
"Very well," said Capling. "I shall start with the morning of the day of the murder. You probably know the date. It was December the 6th last year. Frank had previously been sent into exile by his family as a consequence of theft. You know that already. Banished he was, with no hope of a reprieve.
Well, when his mother Lillian was diagnosed with an illness that her doctor told her was not survivable, when she knew she only had limited time left, it seems that she and Sidney Devonport softened their position somewhat and decided that it was time for Frank to return. He was at the time working as a schoolmaster in Lincolnshire. He and Oliver Proud had put that excess money they should have never had in the first place, profits from the stolen money they invested, into opening a handful of schools. Did you know that?"
"No," I said, only to be corrected by Poirot, who told Capling that, yes, Daisy Devonport had mentioned it to him on the coach, and that he had in turn told me about it. I must have forgotten that detail.
"Very successful schools they were too," Capling went on. "When Frank died, they were sold to the philanthropist Josiah Blantyre for a handsome sum."
"You raise an important question," Poirot said. "Who benefited financially from Frank Devonport's death?"
"Sidney and Lillian Devonport as his next of kin."
"And did you inquire as to the financial position of Sidney and Lillian Devonport?" I asked, thinking of people I knew at Scotland Yard who might not have bothered to do so after Helen Acton had confessed so readily.
"Oh, indeed I did," Capling said proudly. "It was enough to start my eyes watering, I don't mind telling you. The Devonports, senior and junior, have got so much money between them that someone could take away 3/4 of it and they wouldn't notice. Well, they might notice," he amended. "I'm sure they keep a close eye out after what Frank did. But they would still be immensely wealthy, is my point. No member of the Devonport family has any money worries that would induce them to kill anybody, and that's for certain."
"Please return to last year, the 6th of December," said Poirot. "Start at the beginning."
"Frank arrived at Little Quay with his fiancée, Helen Acton, at around 10 o'clock in the morning," said Capling. "When I interviewed them afterwards, Sidney and Lillian Devonport told me that they had felt a certain amount of trepidation about the meeting, the return of their banished son to the family home. They had exchanged letters and spoken over the telephone, but, as I'm sure you can imagine, the prospect of seeing Frank again in the flesh felt rather momentous to them. After communication had been re-established by letter, Frank had given them news of his engagement to a woman they did not know. What is more, he proposed to bring her with him, a stranger. Lillian made a point of telling me that she had nothing against the young lady, not before that terrible day, I mean to say, but both she and Sydney would have preferred Frank to arrive alone for his first visit after the period of estrangement.
Did they communicate this to Frank?
Poirot asked.
No, said Capling. They assured me that they offered Helen their warmest welcome and kept their preferences to themselves.
They did not wish to endanger the rapprochement.
Indeed they did not, Monsieur Poirot. But let me tell you who they made unwelcome that day. Everybody else. Some good friends of the family were staying with the Devonports at the time. Godfrey and Verna LaViolette, whom you've met, of course. Well, they and the rest of the Devonport family were told that Sydney and Lillian would need to be alone with Frank and Helen when they first arrived. And I have the impression that no one is ever willing to argue with Sydney Devonport when he gets a bee in his bonnet about something. So they were ejected from the house, one and all.
Ejected? Poirot repeated in a neutral voice.
That's right. They went to the home of a neighbour, though not a near neighbour. It was a house on the other side of the Kingfisher Hill estate. Kingfisher's View, that was its name. Daisy Devonport complained to me that it had taken an age to walk there and back.
Kingfisher's View? I looked at Poirot. Wasn't that the name of Little Key when it belonged to the LaViolettes, before the Devonports changed it?
No. Little Key was originally called Kingfisher's Rest.
Oh, yes, you're right. Why do you suppose everybody on the estate feels compelled to name everything they own Kingfisher this or that? Kingfisher's Rest, Kingfisher's View, the Kingfisher Coach Company? It's a bit much. The Devonports must be the only residents with some imagination.
Mon ami, only a moment ago you complained that they are all liars with too much of the imagination. Continue, please, Inspector Capling.
Sydney and Lillian had their reunion with Frank, and they met Helen. All went well, from what I understand. The only other person in the house at the time was Winifred Lord, a servant. The LaViolettes and Richard and Daisy Devonport were at Kingfisher's View, and Winifred, Winnie, as I believe she's commonly known, was going to fetch them once Sydney had given permission for them to return. She did this at around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, though before that, at a quarter to two, Oliver Proud had returned from London, and he went straight to Kingfisher's View as he had been instructed. Then they all waited there, Richard, Daisy, Oliver and the LaViolettes, until they were summoned.
So to summarise, Frank Devonport and Helen Acton arrived at Little Key at 10, and then Oliver Proud, the LaViolettes and Richard and Daisy Devonport arrived at 2 o'clock or shortly afterwards, said Poirot.
I believe Oliver stayed a little longer than the others at Kingfisher's View, said Marcus Capling. But yes, he too arrived at Little Key in due course. After that, nothing remarkable happened until the murder itself, as far as I'm aware, and going by what I was told. Frank, Richard and Daisy were all overjoyed to see each other again, from all accounts, and spent much of the afternoon in lively conversation, catching up on each other's news. The LaViolettes, who were Frank's godparents, were delighted to see him. It was a happy occasion, everyone says so. And then, at 20 minutes before 6 o'clock, Marcus Capling stopped. His expression had grown more solemn.
Go on, Poirot urged.
At 20 minutes before six, Frank Devonport fell to his death from the landing. High up in that enormous entrance hall. He'd been pushed over the banana leaf balcony, fell and cracked his head open on the hard floor beneath.
Banana leaf, I said.
Poirot gave me an impatient look.
Do you not observe what is in front of your eyes, Catchpole? The iron of the balcony has the pattern of many little leaves.
I did not notice, no.
They're banana leaves, Capling repeated.
Verna LaViolette told me all about it. The balcony was designed by a friend of hers and her husband's. It was a later addition to the house once they'd bought it. The original balcony was ugly, she said. I didn't ask her about the balcony, you understand, but she seemed to want to talk about it. All that mattered to me was whether a woman of Helen Acton's height and frame could have pushed Frank Devonport over it into his death. My men and I soon saw that it was easily possible. Frank was tall, and the balcony is not especially high. Helen would only have needed to give him a hard shove to the back, and he'd have gone flying over. Well,
as he did. I shall never forget all that blood, Capling went on. When I first arrived at the scene, only for an instant, mind you, I thought I was looking at a large dark red rug with a man lying on it. He shook his head to banish the image.
So you established that Helen Acton was also on this high landing when Frank fell, Poirot said.
Oh, yes, there's no doubt about that, said Capling. Helen was up there, all right. She wasn't the only one. Sydney and Lillian were up there too, and Daisy, and Verna LaViolette. As soon as Frank hit the ground, Helen came running down the stairs like a rocket on fire and announced that she was the one who'd done it. Ask Oliver Proud, he'll tell you. They all will. Nearly all of them heard her, though it was Proud she'd landed on at the bottom of the stairs. She grabbed him by the arms and said, I killed him, Oliver. God help me, Frank's dead. And I'm the one who killed him.